Hello, and welcome to the London Writer Salon podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Parul. And each week we sit down with a writer that we admire to talk about the craft of writing and the art of building a successful and sustainable writing career.
These interviews are recorded live with our global writing community. If you would like to join us for the next recording or write with us at our daily Writer's Hour writing sessions, head to londonwritersalon.com for more information.
In this interview, we talk to someone that we've admired and followed for years, Stephen Pressfield. You might know Stephen Pressfield from his best-selling book for creatives, The War of Art, or maybe from his first published novel that became the major film, The Legend of Bagger Vance, or maybe you've read his historical fiction novels like Gates of Fire or A Man at War. But, you know, before these career-defining accomplishments, Pressfield faced decades of rejection and destitution before anyone really gave a damn about his writing. And so in this very special conversation with Stephen Pressfield, we chat about what it means to have a creative calling, how faith in something bigger than ourselves can play a role in our creative lives. We talk about his experience of writing and writing across multiple genres, and we dig into his latest book, the memoir, Government Cheese. This was such a life-affirming, uplifting chat with a master creative. So, without further ado, we hope you enjoy our conversation with Stephen Pressfield.
And if you're loving these conversations and want to help support the podcast, please rate and review us wherever you listen to us. Each month, we give away prizes to our reviewers, things like mugs and stickers and other goodies. Plus, it's just a nice way to show us your love and to help keep us going. Thanks so much for listening. Welcome to the London Writers' Salon, Mr. Stephen Pressfield.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be here.
Steve, this is, we were saying before we opened, this is one of the highlights of our year, just to be here with you and do this. We've been long fans of your work, and so many in the community are too. So this is a special moment for all of us. We actually consider you one of our patron saints that you might not know. Patron saints of something we do called Writer's Hour. It's a community silent writing sprint where we put our butts where our hearts want to be, and we do the work.
That sounds great. I like it.
So first, thank you for everything you give us. So we like to start with your early writing life, and we're fortunate that you've put so much of this period into Government Cheese and into some of your other books. And in Government Cheese, you write that you lugged around your Smith Corona typewriter for 7 years in your van before you even had an inkling to write, before you began to see an interest in writing, let alone a destiny. Why do you think you carried that damn thing around for so many years?
Well, it's actually a little different than that, Matt. I actually had tried to write a book before that, and for like 2 years, supported by my wife. And I, at the end of it, I just blew the book up, you know, totally sabotaged myself and the marriage and everything. And that sort of cast me out kind of on the road, living by myself in the Chevy van. And I kept the typewriter with me. You know, it's almost like if it was a novel and you were writing about somebody trying to, you know, that was fighting his writing demons, you would give them a typewriter and have them throw it in the back under a pile of junk and never touch it. And that was, so as I was carrying this typewriter, I hated it. You know, there were many times, as I say in Government Cheese, where I was ready to just throw it off a bridge or something like that. I never got it out, not even to write a letter, but it was always with me, kind of like the dream that I had no courage to pursue. And I suppose I thought one day I would take it out, and I finally did. So yeah, that's why I lugged it around all that time.
You remember the first tug that might have been the seed of your calling as a writer? And was it those first couple of years that you tried to write the book and then blew it up? Do you remember that first tug that you thought, actually, this might be something?
Yeah, I got into the writing business for all the wrong reasons and in the dumbest possible way. I was like a junior copywriter at a big ad agency in New York. And I had a boss named Ed Hannibal, and he wrote a novel and it became a hit, an overnight hit. It was called Chocolate Days, Popsicle Weeks, and he quit the business. And so I'm 21 or 22 years old, and I thought, well, why don't I do that too? How hard could it possibly be? So in other words, I didn't really feel any great tug or calling. I was just an idiot. And I just thought, you know, how hard can it be? Let me give it a shot too.
And so was that first book that you then wrote after the one that you blew up. Was that the Bethesda transfer?
Yeah, that was the second one. The first one I actually finished, yeah, which was like about 7 years later than that.
And it would be another 10 years before you actually got your first check from writing, and another 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
After your first novel, The Legend of Bag of Ants, was published.
Yeah, so I was like 52, I think, when my first novel actually got published.
And this feels like a bit of a big question, but what do you think kept you going throughout those decades? I know you've written a whole memoir about it.
There were times during that period when I kind of tried to go straight, tried to get a real job. But every time I would do that, I would be so depressed at the end of the day, you know, that I would have to just try to write something at night, whatever it was. It was the only thing, the only activity that I had. And I'm sure a lot of the people who are listening to this will say the exact same thing. It's the only thing that kept me sane or gave me any kind of hope that I, you know, wasn't utterly wasting my life. So that was part of it, Powell. But another part was, before I was able to get a novel published, I had about a 10-year career as a screenwriter in Hollywood. And so not only did that kind of pay the bills, for the first time in my life, I actually was making a little money, but I was really learning the craft. Screenwriting, and I'm sure there are a bunch of screenwriters in the audience right now, it's all about story. Like William Goldman said, screenplays are structure, you know? So I felt like through that time, even though I wasn't really living what I really, really, really wanted to do, I was learning the craft. You know, I was getting beaten up and learning, you know, in the school of hard knocks. So that was what kept me going. But another thing, Barrel, was I just didn't have a plan B. You know, this was it. So that's what kept me going. There was no alternative.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear you talk about it. And going back to this novel that you blew up along with your life, this idea of self-sabotage comes in. And I think it's something we can all relate to. I feel like many of us do that unwittingly. Do you have any sense on, why did you self-sabotage? And why do we writers do that? Why do we do that in the creative field?
Well, as if anybody that's read my book, The War of Art, knows that I've given a name, at least in my own mind, to this force of self-sabotage, which I call resistance with a capital R. And at the time when I blew up that book, I had no concept that such a thing existed at all. But now I've become like a total student of this demonic force. And it certainly strikes us as writers, I think, at very predictable points. You know, one is just before we start, right? It'll stop us from even starting. And there are a number of other places along the way. But at the very end, at the finish line, is another place where resistance really will hit us, self-sabotage. Because we're at the point then of exposing our work to the world, right? Exposing it to judgment. And that's a very scary thing, right? What if it's terrible? What if nobody notices it? Or even worse, what if it succeeds? And then what do we do? So I think a lot of times we writers are not aware of this internal force. We just suddenly find ourselves acting out. You know, people, you'll lose your manuscript. You'll delete the file, right? Or there are any other number of ways. I mean, do you guys, you know who Seth Godin is, correct?
Huge fans, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I love Seth. Now, he has a term for this. He calls it shipping, right? And he thinks of it in terms like, you know, if we were inventing the iPhone, if we were Steve Jobs, you can noodle around with it, but there comes a point when it's ready to ship. And you got to sort of say, okay, you know, 20 million of these are going out to Apple stores. And that's a really scary moment. So that was really, you know, I had no clue. I was just at the end of something and I just didn't have the guts. I choked. It's like a football player fumbling on the 1 yard line.
Do you think sometimes resistance or the thought that we shouldn't finish could be that we are simply meant to pull away from the work? How do you discern when it's time to pull the pin and when it's time to actually keep going?
I have a kind of, it's like the question sort of is, we hear in our heads the voice of self-doubt, right? Is this any good? Is this really what we're trying to do? Or is this really us? Or are we trying to fake it and pretend some, that kind of stuff, right? And that's the same voice that resistance speaks in. And so the sort of the question you're asking, I think, is how do you know when it's resistance or when it's legitimate? You know, and I have a rule of thumb, which I say is when in doubt, it's resistance. You know, almost all the time, that seductive voice is resistance. And at least for me, because my big demon was not being able to finish something, that was the real hurdle that I had to get over with. Ever since then, I'm like crazed to finish everything. So for me, I won't abandon anything, even if it's really terrible or turns out to be terrible, I'm going to finish it. And whether that's right or not, I don't know. But I just think it's always a good thing to finish, even if it doesn't work.
Seems like a big part of being a writer is figuring out what works for you.
Yes.
And it sounds like it works for you, so you don't want to mess with the magic of it.
Yeah. But here's another thing that I've found. Like, I would say for me, at least 2/3 of the way through any project, any book, I'm racked with self-doubt. It's not until I've almost got a real readable draft done that I start to say to myself, you know, maybe this might be okay. And I think that's a good thing. That to me is a sign. It's the voice of self-doubt is the voice of resistance. And the fact that resistance is trying to stop me from doing this tells me that I need to do it. That's a constant for me, self-doubt, until maybe 2/3 of the way through and I finally start to think, okay, this is pretty good. Let me just keep going.
And how did this show up for you in Government Cheese?
That's a great question, Matt, because I was really racked with self-doubt for that one, because the way the book, it's a memoir, right? So it actually came from my girlfriend, Diana, who said, you know, she's heard all my stories. And she said, you know, you should put these down. These would be really helpful to people that are trying to write. You know, they can see all the stuff that you went through, and maybe it'll help them to realize on their journey. So I immediately thought, oh, that's a really dumb idea. I mean, everybody's got a million stories. Who cares about anybody's stories? I don't care about anybody else's. Why is anybody going to care about mine? That, again, of course, that's the voice of resistance. That's what it is, right? But I really bought into it, because for a long time, and I had real self-doubt. I thought, what am I doing writing, you know, a memoir about so many of my failures and all this dumb sort of stuff that everybody else has gone through? But, you know, finally, like I say, maybe 2/3 of the way through, I started to think, you know, maybe this will help somebody. You know, maybe this is a good thing. And at that point, the self-doubt went away. But again, to go back to Seth Godin for a second, he has another thing aside from shipping that I sort of imagine as like a business card. And on one side, it says, this might work. And on the other side, it says, this might not work. And that's sort of where we live as writers, as we're working on something. There's, you know, we're too so close to any project we're working on. There's no way to tell. And even if it's great, if it's like a Van Gogh painting that he never sold one in his entire life, the times might be working against us. And we say, well, it might not work. So anyway, I'm not sure why I said that, but that's it's a great thing. This might not.
Yeah, it's such a powerful concept. And I actually think we say this to ourselves when we launch new projects here, or at least I say it in my own head from Seth Godin, is this might not work, but here it is anyway. I think it's really empowering. So I'm so glad you brought that in.
Yeah, it really is.
I have a feeling that our first ever event, Steve, we had quotes from you and Seth Godin at that in-person event. So I think we do have your voice in our head, actually.
So we are going to get more into Government Cheese in a bit, but there's some more things we do want to talk about. And in particular, you describe your life looking back as a sort of an odyssey. And this can really be a transformative concept to zoom out of our lives and to start to view it as if it's a great story unfolding, seeing low points and obstacles as trials and tribulations a hero is enduring instead of annoying things or problems, things that are important to our spiritual growth. I've had moments where I've zoomed out and it's been really helpful. It's helped me make decisions. But I'm curious for you, when were you able to start shifting and zooming out from being in the mess to looking at this as a story, a game, something that's unfolding for you?
That's a great question. I can tell you this, I never was able to do that while I was in it. It was only like years later thinking back on something. But I do think it's a guarantee, I would say, that if we're pursuing any kind of creative calling, we are on a hero's journey. And it does have meaning. I think in many ways, the worst part of the struggles of anybody in a creative calling is this feeling that it's meaningless, right? That you're worthless, that you're just randomly bobbing from, you know, one wave top to another. But it's not true, because if we hadn't received the call in the first place, think of the hero's journey, right? We wouldn't be trying to do it at all. And I'm sure all of our listeners here are familiar with, you know, Joseph Campbell's concept of the hero's journey. And I want to recommend a book. If you haven't read this book, have you heard of a book called The Writer's Journey?
Yeah.
It's really a great one. But anyway, if we hadn't received the call, we wouldn't have moved from the ordinary world to the extraordinary world. And we wouldn't be in that hero's journey of meeting allies and enemies and shapeshifters and eventually coming to confront the villain, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe it does give meaning to that, to be in it. I'm actually doing a little video series on Instagram now that I call A Passage Through the Wilderness, which is really what Government Cheese is. That memoir is sort of, it's really about it. The book ends, as you know, with my first success. So it's all about the years when there's no success. And those wilderness paths, a lot of people I'm sure that are listening now are in the wilderness one way or another. And I can guarantee you there is meaning and you are on a hero's journey and it is a journey home. And if you can just hang in there, you will get back to Ithaca just like Odysseus did.
It is a journey home. I love that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people needed to hear that, Steve. Thank you. So the concept of resistance with a capital R, we've touched on that. That's from The War of Art, and you continue to talk about it in your other work. Is there anything that you think people get wrong about resistance or don't understand? Maybe it just hasn't sunk in for them what it actually is, but is there anything you think people misunderstand about the resistance?
Okay, I'll try that because I haven't really talked to people about it, but if there's anything, I would say that people underestimate the diabolical pill nature of resistance, that they think, oh, that's just a little bit of self-sabotage. I'll just blow past it. But it's a constant, extremely intelligent, always adaptive, witty, clever force that is relentless. And for me, like 50 years into my writing career, it's just as powerful today as it ever was for me. And even worse, because it gets more nuanced, you know, in terms of, you know, seductive reasoning to throw me off the track. So I really say if you're in the creative arts or any kind of entrepreneurial venture, and you're not top of mind aware of your own self-sabotage, to the point that you're absolutely, it's the first thing you think about in the morning in terms of combating it, slaying the dragon every morning, you're in a vulnerable position because this is an enemy that aims to kill. And it has left a lot of casualties by the side of the road who didn't take it seriously enough.
One thing that I love about the way you talk about resistance is how critics and criticisms are just an extension of resistance. And often they're echoing what's in our mind. For me, that was something that personally resonated with me, because I think many of us fear the outside critics, but the minute you frame it as resistance, it's just another dragon to slay.
It's true. I mean, the danger, like Hemingway said, I know we all know these things. He said, you know, if you believe the critics when they tell you you're good, then you have to believe them when they tell you you're bad. So in other words, don't believe them at all. Don't read anything at all. But what's really harmful about negative feedback that you get from anybody is not that that feedback is right, because I think usually it isn't. Most people who are criticizing things are criticizing out of envy or out of an inner, they don't know what they're talking about. They're idiots, you know? But what's the danger, as you just said, Powell, is that that voice reinforces the voice we've already got in our head that says, you're a loser, you're no good, you can't do this, this is a bad idea, et cetera, et cetera. So we have to treat those voices if we can. It's not easy. It's not easy for anybody. It's certainly not easy for me to dismiss it just like we dismiss any other form of resistance when we hear that voice in our head.
Mm. One of the things that really landed for me on resistance was you saying the greater the resistance, the more important this thing is to our soul's evolution. And I think I paraphrase that.
No, that's absolutely true.
Can you speak a little to that? Because when we're staring at decades of rejection, when we're in the shit, it's hard to look at it that way. Can you explain that a little bit?
I just think it's a law, just like Newton's law of physics or law of motion or whatever the hell it is, that the more important a project is to the evolution of our soul, the more resistance we will feel toward it. So if we're trying to decide between at the start, between project A and project B, we can ask ourselves, which one am I most afraid of? And that's the one that we should do. And the way I sort of visualize this is, if you think about a tree in the middle of a sunny meadow, the tree is the dream. The tree is the project that we want to do. Immediately, that when that tree appears, a shadow is going to appear, right? The tree produces a shadow. The shadow is resistance. And the shadow is equal and opposite to the tree, equal and opposite to the dream. So the bigger the shadow, the bigger the dream. So if you're feeling massive resistance, then that's a good sign, because it tells you that you've kind of tapped into some project that's really, really important to you. Anytime I see some writer, any artist that says, oh, I love my new project, I'm so excited, it's going to be so good, and I'm writing it so well, I think this is an idiot. You know, the proper answer is, I'm freaked out. I have no idea if this is any good. I must be a complete jerk to try to tackle this. It's way beyond me, but I'm going to do it. That's what you should be saying. Again, following the law of resistance, the more important the project is, the more resistance we will feel.
And I love what you said about the bigger the shadow, the bigger the dream. It's a good reminder. I would love to talk a little bit about a theme that comes up in Government Cheese, and that's pain. And I think it's possibly mentioned in The War of Art as well. It's this idea of you can write through pain, write about pain. And you say, how do we transcend it? We turn it into art. And I suppose I have a question around, when is the right time to actually write about pain? What if we're in the middle of it or too close to it?
At least in my experience, while you're in the middle of it, you can't do it. What you're really trying to do is to get to a professional remove from, you know, zoom back out just enough to be able to see yourself, you know, from the ceiling, you know, looking down at yourself. At least for me, when I've been in that pain and tried to write about it, I can't do it. I can write it, but what I write is no good. It's too close to it. It's sort of like a journal. You know, that's what a lot of my bad early writings were like. They were like the journal of somebody in therapy, you know, and if you were to show it to somebody, they'd be embarrassed for you. You know, they'd say, oh, you poor bastard, you know? So it seems like, at least for me, to transcend it, you do need to get some distance from it. The broken heart's got to heal a little bit, I think.
It's a great tip. Thanks for sharing, Steve. Yeah, it's good. It's interesting because we interview writers of all sorts, and this is a theme. I don't know if you know Tim Grawl.
Oh, yeah, I do. Yeah.
Yeah, he put it right from the scar, not from the wound. And he probably borrowed it from someone. So it seems like there's some...
Oh, I like that. I think that's really good. Hey, God bless him. That's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a couple other titles of books that we'd like to introduce in addition to The War of Art. But you have these catchphrases that just reading the title, you're like, you get it. So one of them's, and earmuffs, there will be some swearing because Steve, you like to put swear words in lots of your books. One of them's do the work. Another one is put your ass where your heart wants to be. But the one I want to ask about is nobody wants to read your shit. These are hard pills to swallow.
Love that title.
And you say in that book, sometimes young writers acquire the idea from their years in school that the world is waiting to read what they've written. In the real world, no one is waiting to read what you've written. Some tough talk. Why is this important to realize as writers?
That's a great question, man. I think it's, you know, where this became really clear to me was when I worked in advertising. And I'll bet there are plenty of people listening who have worked in advertising or try to write copy, is you realize from instant one, when you're writing an ad or doing a TV commercial, that nobody wants to hear it. If they've got a remote, they're going to click right through it. If it's a magazine ad, they're going to turn the page. They hate it. I don't want to hear an ad for Preparation H or for anything else, right? And you also realize You know, if you're living in New York and you're doing a one act play that's going to be off Broadway, you can't even get your mother to come to see it. You know, it's like, it's not like people are mean or anything, but they're busy, you know? So the bottom line, if you're a writer or any kind of artist, is you got to make that thing, that project, that book, that's so good, so compelling, so funny, so unique that people would be crazy not to come and look at it, you know? But it's always, just like it's really important to understand the concept of resistance, that you're going to sabotage yourself. The other thing that's really important to know as a writer is that nobody wants to read your shit. You know, you got to make them, you know, as you're sitting down, as you're writing any paragraph, and I'm sure we all do this, you have to sort of be thinking in your head, how is the reader going to read this? Is this interesting? Is this sentence interesting? Is the next sentence interesting? You know, is this chapter, will this chapter pull somebody through? Because remember, people are busy. They got so many other distractions and things to do. So it's just sort of a way of cracking the whip over yourself and just saying, this better be really, really good, what I'm doing, before I put it out there.
And it's a great reminder. It's a great practice in empathy, too, because sometimes we forget to put the reader hat on when we write because we need to get it out. But actually, we need to put that hat on and practice that empathy.
Exactly. And like, even like if we were opening a restaurant and we're hoping people are going to come in off the street and eat our food, we got to, you know, when we sample our own food, we have to keep asking, is this good? Is this really good? Is this really, really good? And as we go through a meal, you know, from appetizer to entree and so on and so forth, are they going in a proper order that's going to, you know, the palate is going to move from one to the other, and et cetera. Empathy, just like you said.
Yeah. Just a good transition, I think, into some of your fiction work.
Yes.
Which you practice this wonderfully.
Right. I was going to say, empathy for the readers is definitely evident in your historical fiction. It's interesting to go through your work and see how you're drawn to wars and drawn to talking about battles. You make moments in history so interesting because of your empathy for the readers. And what I found really curious was how you, the story within your stories are always about overcoming adversity, battles of the sort of smaller army, the smaller force against the larger enemy. And I'm just curious about your interest in war battles, how you and why you have been drawn to these very specific battles. So, for example, the Lionsgate is about the Six-Day War in Israel in 1967. They've got Tides of War, which is the Peloponnesian War. I'm just curious about, yeah, how are you choosing the battles and how are you deciding on the characters to focus on?
Well, I certainly see life as a battle. You know, it's the war of art is the internal battle against our own self-sabotage, the fight that we fight inside our heads. But I think life is a battle in the outer world, too. So in a way, when I write about warfare or something, it's a metaphor for the inner war. But to take it another step beyond this parallel, it's like I'm definitely a believer in the muse. You know, I believe that our ideas come to us from a place that transcends reason we don't really know. And a lot of times, almost all the time, I'll say, I get seized with an idea, and it's a complete surprise to me. It's not like I sit down rationally and think, what subject should I work on next? You know, in fact, every time I've tried to do that, it's been a disaster. So, but rather, I sort of feel a calling, or I'm seized by an idea, and I'm sort of compelled to do it. And for whatever reason, like my books, Gates of Fire and Tides of War, the first two books after the first one, were warfare in the ancient world. And when I thought of it, I thought, why me? Why? I don't know anything about that. But once I sort of got into it, which was not too hard, I thought, wow, this is really fascinating. So it's sort of a mystery. I really can't answer that, the why I'm doing that, in any sort of rational way. It's just... you know, the muse knows what she's doing, even if we don't.
I like the surrender that you talk about. That's why I've been thinking a lot about surrender in reading your books, because you talk about essentially letting the creativity flow through you.
I'm curious how, when you hear the call from the muse with these ideas, how does it actually show up? Is it literally a voice in your head? Are you noticing things in the world and you're connecting the dots? How does the muse speak to you to say, okay, this is what's next?
It's come in different ways to me. One way that it sort of comes is either I'll have an idea or somebody will suggest something to me and I'll immediately reject it. You know, like a friend once said to me, you know, you should write a book about Alexander the Great. And I go, oh, that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard, you know. And what'll happen is it'll sort of percolate for, and a month later, the idea will pop back into my head and say, you know, maybe I should think about that a little bit. And then I'll reject it again. And then, you know, a month after that, I'll sort of, maybe I'll say, let me just write, start a file. You know, if I were going to do this, what would I do? How would I do it? And I'll write, you know, something maybe for a couple of hours, and then I'll forget that too. I'll walk away and just forget it. And then 3 months later, I'll find it again. And I'll go, wow, that's a good idea. And then it'll sort of grab me. Now, another, maybe I'm getting into too much detail on this or blathering on, but.
No, please go.
Not at all. This is perfect.
Another book that I wrote that was about Alexander the Great, the way that happened was two sentences came into my head. And I knew they were the first two sentences of a book, but I had no idea. And the two sentences were, I have always been a soldier. I have known no other life. And I thought, ah, that's a great start to a book. But I said to myself, who's saying it? Who is this person? Is it a contemporary person? You know, and it was like months before I sort of, after going back to it a few times, I saw, oh, this is Alexander the Great. And this is going to be his story. So that's kind of how that one came to me. It's all different ways.
I love hearing about how these ideas come to you. I'm curious, how faithful are you to an idea and a story once you start researching and writing it? Or do you find that you're attracted to lots of other ideas that come into your space?
You mean like faithful to the historical reality of it?
No, faithful to the story, meaning you don't put it down and start writing something else.
Ah, I'm pretty faithful. I'm definitely a believer in doing one thing at a time, although I have violated that a few times. But I think I really sort of live my life project to project, like an actor or a director in the movies or in on the stage, right? So once I'm into something, I'm faithful to it. And I really believe, you know, believing in the muse as I do, I feel like the goddess sort of gives you an assignment and you better stick with it. Or she's going to be pissed off, you know? She gave you this thing to do. You better do it.
You have years of listening, tuning into that frequency of the muse. And I'm curious if anyone's listening saying, I've never heard a whisper. I don't even know what she sounds like. How to pay attention. Do you have any ideas or advice on how someone might start to listen? What that those early days of listening might look like?
You know, I really think ideas are coming to us constantly. Usually in those moments, you're driving, you're in the, on the subway or in the shower, somewhere where your ego is disengaged, or even when you're kind of half asleep in a kind of a twilight state or something like that. But I think what we do sometimes is we just dismiss those ideas. We don't take them seriously. They sort of come and go. And probably all kinds of great ideas have gone in one ear and out the other for a lot of us, you know. I think a big part of the skill of being an artist or a creative person is recognizing those ideas as they pass by. Like Roseanne Cash has this thing where she says, a singer has to have a catcher's mitt, has to travel with a catcher's mitt, so that when the ball comes through, she can grab it, you know? And she says, otherwise it'll wind up in Lucinda Williams's house. So I think we just have to be as aware as we possibly can be of anything that's passing through, because it's from the cosmic radio station. That's one of my analogies. And the radio station is always broadcasting. And we just have to learn how to tune that dial, you know, just listen a little harder. There's another book I know that I want to recommend that I know you guys know. It's by Rick Rubin, the music producer, The Creative Act. And his word for the muse is source with a capital S. And in his view, source is broadcasting constantly and to everybody, not only to artists, right, but to everybody. But it passes over our heads a lot of the time. But he feels like we live kind of in an ocean of great ideas coming.
Hmm. And the artist is one that can listen and capture and run with those ideas. Really, I love that book. Yeah, just finished it. Highly recommend.
Stephen, we'd love to talk about the Foolscap method. It's something that I've heard in association with your name many times before. My understanding is that Norm Stahl gave you advice on how to outline your book. And he said to you, Steve, this is my impression of him. Steve, God made a single sheet of foolscap to be exactly the right length to hold the outline of an entire novel. And so I'm curious whether the foolscap is where you start when you think about novels, whether it's fiction, nonfiction.
I do. I actually have done an Instagram series of like 5-minute short videos that anybody can find that's about the foolscap method. And basically, the concept is that on a single sheet of yellow foolscap, a legal pad from my friend Norm Stahl, who just passed away, you know, a few months ago, great mentor to me and great friend.
God bless him.
So he just said, God made a single sheet of yellow foolscap the exact right length to hold the outline of an entire novel. And so the breakthrough of that, the concept of that is that not to become so precious or over-prepared or over-researched that you write a Bible for every character and all that kind of thing. He says, just on one page, you can get the whole idea. And I've sort of evolved my own version of what it is. And I have like 10 different points that I want to answer. But what it'll do, I think, is if you can get it all on one page, this is, it goes back to Seth Godin's, this might work, this might not work. You can sort of look at it and say, I think this will work. You know, if we say, okay, we have the idea for the movie Rocky. It's Rocky, he's in Philadelphia, he gets a chance to fight the champ. And the final scene is he does fight the champ. And we look at it and we go, well, you know, this could be a pretty good movie. So that's the foolscap method. The idea of getting it all down on one page as a way of evaluating something and also giving ourselves confidence, you know, that this could be a good idea. It works from page one to the end.
And we'll link to the videos and to your Instagram later on in the show notes. I'm just curious if you're able to talk us through some of the, I know you said there are 10 components to the foolscap for you, even just the top three questions that you are asking yourself when you're looking at a novel.
The first question, and really this is, in a way, this is what an editor, what a really good editor does. So you're sort of being your own editor. So the first question I always ask is, what's the genre? Is this a love story? Is this a Western? Is this a science fiction? Is it two genres combined? And I just want to identify that for sure. And the reason I want to identify that is, you know, genres have conventions, right? If we're doing a love story, we have to have them meet cute. We have to have a rival. We have to have the lovers go apart before they come back together. So if I know the genre, I've already got a kind of a, at least a vague roadmap of what the story would be. So that's number one. Number two for me is hero and villain, right? Who's the hero? Who's the villain? If we're writing Moby Dick, it's Captain Ahab and it's the white whale. And then there are other kind of rules of, and the third one that I always, if we're going to pick the most important, is how does it end? What's the climax? And when we know the climax, we can work backwards from that to, so if you can answer these, like I say, these 10 questions, you really get a sense of what the story is all about. Like just for a small example here, what we're talking about.
Yeah.
One of the principles of a story is hero and villain clash in the climax, right? If it's a Western, it's a gunfight between, you know, if it's John Wick, we know he's going to take on the villain. If it's Luke Skywalker, he's going to be going after the Death Star in the final moment. So if we know who hero and villain are, then we can sort of grope towards the climax. Well, how do they clash? Over what? Where? You know? Anyway, that's sort of a nutshell version of the foolscap method. On the other hand, I have also started books with just winging it completely with no idea where I was going. And that can work too. I sometimes will advise people to do that, you know, just start, go follow your instincts and just keep going. And sometimes that'll work.
And for Government Cheese, I'm curious, did you at all go back to or start with a foolscap when you were getting stuck or at the beginning when you were outlining?
I did. I definitely did. I said, you know, who's the hero? Who's the villain? And all of those things. But I also sort of, I couldn't quite really get it. So I just started, you know, and sometimes that helps too. If you're stuck and you can't really, you don't, we can't really answer all those questions. Sometimes if you just plunge in, you know, after a month, you go, oh, that's the answer to what this is, you know? So I'm a believer in both ways of doing it, thinking it out, but also just trusting your instincts.
Yeah, well, that's really helpful because obviously we're in different stages or different mindsets, depending on what we're working on and the time of life we're at, time of day we're in.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's turn back to government cheese and keep going deeper into it. So you've infused your story in The War of Art and in other books, and you talked about why this and how this book came about. Diana encouraged you to write it, and eventually you did. And you also mentioned where you got stuck, the self-doubt. Was that the dark night of the soul moment with this book, or were there any others as you were writing it? Was it who the hell cares? Or was there anything else that came up for you?
Now, that was pretty much the self-doubt just all the way through. There was no like real moment when I was ready to give it up or anything like that. Because like I say, you guys, I know you're familiar with John Keats's concept of negative capability. Does that ring a bell? If not, this is really good. This is worth Googling. John Keats wrote a letter to his brother in 1804 or something like that. And he defined this quality that he thought an artist had to have. And he said, above all others, he thought Shakespeare had this. And he called it negative capability. And what he meant by that was that while we're in the midst of doubts and uncertainty, to be able to keep plowing forward and not let those doubts overcome us. So to sort of answer your question, Matt, like there wasn't any particular moment of the dark night of the soul. It was a constant dark night of the soul where I just knew from experience, just keep going, keep going, keep going. And the analogy I sometimes use is like Columbus sailing to the New World. Like he thought the world was round, but everybody else was telling him it's not round. You're going to sail off the end. But somehow he had to find the courage to keep going and do it day after day. And we do too as artists.
Mm. So you mentioned this was a book that you just kind of started to plow in. What did day one look like for you? What was the first, those first few words that you wrote down, the stories that you told? What did day one look like for this book?
You know, I'm not sure I even remember. I think I started, there was like one particular really black moment in my life where I got fired from a job driving a delivery trucks because I stole a can of grapefruit juice. So I thought, let me start there, you know, and I don't even know why. And then I had another thought to add a chapter before that, a chapter about the typewriter that I had, but I can't quite remember, Matt. I just sort of plunged in.
Yeah, that's good. And I'm curious because that we've heard, I don't know if this is advice necessarily you're giving, but sometimes we've heard people say, when you're not sure where to start, you start with that moment that's on your heart, the heaviest thing, the thing that you just need to work with. I don't know if that would be advice to just start with.
Sometimes that is pretty good advice. You know, start at the moment when, you know, you're getting your stomach pumped from an overdose of whatever, you know, that kind of thing. Like Carrie Fisher started Postcards from the Edge with.
Yeah. I wonder if we zoom out a little bit. But you mentioned going through the wilderness, and this book is about your wilderness period. What's your hope for the book? Us as readers and writers writing this book, what's your hope for Government Cheese?
My selfish hope is that I will at least have gotten down, if I die tomorrow, if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, that my family, the kid, little kids in my family can read something and say, oh, this is what, you know, Uncle Steve was, this was his thing. That's my selfish kind of hope. But my unselfish hope is that, like our audience right now that we're talking to, that anybody, somebody that's out there and struggling and thinking, you know, my journey is meaningless, I'm going nowhere, that they could read this book and be encouraged and say, it seemed meaningless to Steve too. And it wasn't. So that would be my hope, that this would provide some sustenance, because I noticed I went on a couple of podcasts before I started this book. And one was Rich Roll's podcast and the other was Tim Ferriss's podcast. And they both were really curious about like the real life connective tissue moments. Like I think Rich said to me I'm driving trucks, right? And he says, but you had an agent. He said, how did you have an agent when you never wrote anything? You know, how did that happen? And I think I'm interested in other people's stories that way too. It's like, where were you living? You were living there, and you were, how did you make money? And how did you meet so-and-so? And where did that idea come from? And a lot of times in books that are written for artists or to encourage them, the writer leaves that out. And it's just principles of, you know, do this, do that, whatever. So I wanted to put those moments in just because they're so real.
It's a beautiful book. We loved it. We highly recommend it.
What I love about it, the details. I've never spent so much time with a driver in the truck racing across America.
Steve, you put so much work into essentially created a publishing company, and you printed these, you're publishing them, you're sending them out, seemingly yourself, you and Diana. So can you tell us about this decision to run this, build this publishing company and print these yourself? And it's beautiful. I mean, when these books arrived, just to explain to everyone, it's, I don't know if you're doing all of them like this, but at least the early ones that we got, signed copy in a beautiful box, signed box, sealed.
Beautiful bookmark.
Yeah. So first, well done. You wowed us.
Yeah, probably one of the best deliveries I've seen of a book.
Definitely.
Ah, well, that was all Diana's doing, designing it. But the way where this idea came from, it came from our friend Jack Carr, the thriller writer that does the James Reese series, The Terminal List.
Yes.
And we saw a few years ago, he did this, it's kind of a VIP pack, not as a marketing device or anything, but he was just sending it to friends. And so he sent out, this was his third book, I think, Savage Son. And he sent out a beautiful little box with a few little premiums in it, a coaster, a little utility knife, a signed copy of the book. And when you open it up, you go, wow, this is great. You know, so we just thought, let's do this too, you know, and just to surprise people. It's also kind of following Seth Godin's advice to underpromise and overdeliver, because this was signed copies. So people had to pay extra. It was like $40 to get a signed copy. And we wanted people, when they got it, to think, oh, this is really cool. So it was all Diana's doing. She's the brains behind all of this.
So I have a question around your decision to work within or own Indie Press. So before this, you also had Black Irish Press as well.
Yes.
And on one of your blog posts there, I saw someone ask about your decision to publish. I think it was Gates of Fire with a larger publisher. And you made a comment to say, well, sometimes a larger publisher is just better for distribution. So some books, I think you're saying, are suitable for larger publishing houses, and some books are suitable for indie publishing. Is that your philosophy on?
I believe that. I may be wrong, but certainly I feel like for me, my fiction, my historical fiction, a book like Gates of Fire or Tides of War or any of those, I think are better coming out from a mainstream, you know, big five publisher. I'm not sure why, because publishers don't really do very much these days. They really sort of throw it back to you, the individual writer. You know, they're asking you how many followers do you have and what social media are you going to do and that kind of stuff. But still, I think it sometimes those books need more credibility. Whereas for me, my other books about writing, like The War of Art, there is a following for them already. And also, this is kind of interesting, I really can't find a publisher for those. People don't want to bring them out. Believe it or not.
Huh.
So it makes more sense to publish it independently.
Yeah. And presumably like you say, if you have an audience, it makes more sense.
Yeah.
And we've heard that you mentioned on other podcasts that it's been a lot of work.
Yeah. Fortunately, Diana does most of the work, but yeah, it is a lot of work, a lot of work.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would recommend it.
That's what I was going to ask is, do you think you would do this again? Or is this kind of the best thing you'll never do again kind of thing?
I would do it again. And I intend to do it again. We intend to do it again, mainly because most of the work is front loaded. We've already done it. We've set up an account with Amazon. You know, we know the various people that we're in business with to help us do eBooks, help us do audiobooks, that kind of thing. But the front loaded part of the work is really hard, and we've needed a lot of help. But again, the big thing is, how do you get the word out?
Right.
You know, it's one thing to release a new book or a new album or whatever, but how do you get the word? That's the problem. And I have not figured that out.
Yeah. You might not have figured it out, but I'm curious if you have clues on what has worked. What are some of the things that have shifted? I mean, you've been on some massive podcasts, Rich Roll and Tim Ferriss and Joe Rogan. Have you noticed those shift books, or is it your own fans and your mailing list? Do you have a hunch what's working?
It's only a hunch, because it's not like if you go on Joe Rogan that you can now track sales or anything like that. But I certainly think that those kind of big podcasts, they really help. They really do move the needle. And certainly Instagram and, you know, having as many followers as you can. I mean, I also have a blog that I do once a week, kind of like Seth Godin. He does it every day. You know, there are a lot of people who do it every day. That certainly helps. But I haven't found any magic bullet. It's just a lot of work. And, you know, I don't know. You hope something catches fire.
It's almost reassuring knowing that you don't know, because a lot of people feel like they're missing out.
Or there's some magic answer.
They're missing something because they don't know.
Yeah, I don't think there is.
Yeah, it's reassuring. Thank you.
Do you know who Joanna Penn is?
Yes.
Creative Penn in, you know, she's in England, right? And she does a really interesting, I follow her and I've been on her, and she's an indie writer, and she will interview other indie writers about how they do it. And there's a lot of interesting stuff. Like there's her last book she did, that was called Pilgrimage. It was about three pilgrimages that she took, and she put that out via Kickstarter.
Yes.
Which I thought, whoever thought of that? I actually ordered a book and it would cost like $89 or something like that. So, and then there are other people that she interviews that like they're writers of, let's say, science fiction fantasy worlds, you know, a planet or the war of planets or whatever it is. And they create certain characters that have a following, and then they will bring in other writers. Like one guy was talking about, he brought in 10 other writers to sort of keep writing that universe. And, you know, that's not for me, but it goes to show you. And the guy was also doing NFTs, you know, the whatever crypto, I don't even know what it is. But there are a lot of people are exploring all kinds of ways of getting their stuff out there.
I think, yeah, we're definitely very curious about that kind of bleeding edge of publishing and where it might go.
Yeah, it's fascinating. People are trying all sorts of things. Joanna Penn is a great person to follow. We'll make sure to share a link to her work as well. So we've got maybe a few more minutes, maybe one or two from us, and then we're going to go to the audience. So if you do have a question, now's the time to put it into the chat.
Hello, listeners. Just a note from us at the London Writers Salon. Our interviews are recorded in front of a live online audience. And so at this point in the interview, we turn to audience questions. Would you like to be a part of the live audience and ask your own questions? Head to londonwritersalon.com for more information. You can buy tickets to the online events or get free access to them as a member. Now, back to the interview.
I know Tim Ferriss asked you this as well. Tim Ferriss asked you about the title, but I think it's really important because it links into the end of your book as well, where you talk about this idea of being a writer and the notion of government cheese, which as a British person, I'd never heard of that concept, government cheese. I wonder if you can tell us about the title.
In the days before food stamps or voucher programs, and I think it still goes on today, a way of helping poor people who couldn't put food on the table was that the government would take surplus food, and that was what government cheese is, you know, and would give it away. Dried beans, powdered milk, canned peaches, cheese, that kind of thing. And one of the jobs I had was driving trucks and delivering surplus food to poor communities in the American South. And it was one of my favorite things to do, partly because I thought, this is really doing somebody some good. You know, it's putting food on people's table, keeping people alive. But I felt that it was also a metaphor for writing, for the writer's life. Like, as writers, we're delivering a load, right? We drive in and we back the truck in, we open the doors, and there's this load. And we hope that people will like it. But we didn't make the load. We're just driving it there, you know? And so I feel there's a certain anonymity in a good way to being a writer. I know everybody wants their name out there, but really, these books are coming from someplace else, you know? We're just the driver. And when you delivered the surplus food, it would always be to churches. And you would pull into a lot early in the morning, a parking lot, a car park, as they say in the UK. And you would just sort of park the truck, and they would, the minister would usually ask you just to sort of step aside. You don't have anything to do with it. Leave it to us. We'll offload it. And that's kind of how I feel about writing, that you deliver the load and you kind of step aside.
I feel a sense of freedom when you talk about it that way. And I think just reflecting on what you've, you know, what we've been talking about today, what you've said, how, you know, if we listen hard enough as artists, we can hear what the muse is offering us and deliver it. We're just, it just flows through us. There's a freedom in it. Because in our community, we listen to the writers in the moments of self-doubt, of over-worrying, over-identifying with their work. So it's been really helpful. Mm. Your memoir is wonderful. It's a wonderful insight into the writer's life.
Thank you. Thanks for talking about it.
So if anyone, and you talk about the muse and delivering the truck, if someone's having a hard time kind of getting it, believing that they need to believe in something greater than themselves, that this isn't just about me. Yeah. Any words to help convince them, I guess.
I mean, I think we've all had those moments when we write a few pages on Tuesday and we look at them again on Thursday and we go, wow, this is really good. You know, and in fact, you look at it and you say, this doesn't even seem like it came from me. You know, this is like not my voice, or how did I know how to do that? You know, and when that happens, I think you have to believe in something. You have to say, where did this come from? It's coming from somewhere. And certainly songwriters talk about this all the time, right? They're driving down the highway and a song comes to them, they like screech to the side of the road and dictate it into their phone as fast as they can. So I think we just, when that happens for us, we just have to really believe in it and hang on to that. Self-belief, nobody teaches you that. And it's really hard, particularly if we grew up in a family or in circumstances where we weren't believed in, you know? That's a great thing to have if you can get it, self-belief. Even if you're not believing in yourself, believing in your work, you know, believing that whatever's coming through is a value, because it is.
It's a great, great reminder, Steve. One of the things we like to talk about here is our mountaintop, the things that we're aiming at, the mountaintop in the distance that we're climbing. What is that for you right now?
Like I say, I'm a believer in the muse. I'm a servant of the muse. And I look at the writer's life as like a practice, like a yoga practice or a practice in martial arts. And really all I want to do is keep going and just do the next, whatever the next one is. And then, so there really is no mountaintop for me. I'm just trying to keep going and keep, as long as the goddess has given me ideas, you know, I want to keep doing them and be worthy of them. So far, they haven't run out, you know, knock wood.
That's beautiful. Well, Steve, we're so grateful for everything that you give us, give writers, turning your insights out for us to learn and to feel less alone in our journey, especially what you've been doing with videos lately. We've noticed it, the Instagram, the YouTube, seems like you're really giving back a lot. And I think on behalf of all of us writers, thank you for sharing this with us today, but also your wider career. Thank you, Steve.
And thank you for having me and for, like I said before we came on the air, thanks for reading my stuff so thoughtfully and having such, you know, deep and interesting questions.
Well, Steve, we're such big fans. We're rooting for you all the way. And we'd love to do this again. Thank you.
Likewise. This is great. Thank you very much, you guys.
Thank you for tuning in to the London Writers Salon podcast. If you enjoyed our chat and you'd like to join us for the next one, please visit londonwriterssalon.com for more information on how to become a member. As a member, you will have access to our interview archive, to our workshops, and our cozy online writing community. Whatever kind of writer you are, it is an excellent place to make new creative connections and focus on your craft.
And if you struggle to find time to write, you're welcome to write with us at our daily Writer's Hour writing sessions. It runs Monday to Friday, 4 times a day, and all you need is the desire to write, something to write with, and something to cheers us with. We think it's the world's best virtual co-writing space for writers, creatives, or frankly, anyone who just needs to get some work done. Visit writershour.com to sign up and join us. Until we write again.